On another appointment matter, Lewis was successful. Jefferson had just taken the lead in founding the United States Military Academy at West Point. Lewis suggested using the academy as part of the effort to win over to the American side the French businessmen in the purchased territory. As historian Theodore Crackle puts it, Lewis's plan was simple. The sons of the area's leading citizens should be made cadets and sent to West Point. What better way to bind these families to the new nation and to the Jefferson administration? Dearborn and Jefferson accepted without hesitation. In April, Lewis and Stoddard recommended some young men for appointment to West Point, including Charles Gratiot and two sons of Auguste Chouteau. One of these, Lorimier, was half Indian. Stoddard would not go along with the recommendation for Lorimier because he exhibited too much of the Indian in his color. This circumstance may make his situation among the cadets at the school rather disagreeable. Lewis stuck with the recommendation, and all three got their appointments. Three others were added later. Of the six, five graduated and got commissions, including young Lorimier, who served 3 years and won two promotions. In St. Louis, in the first week of May 1804, there were difficulties and postponements connected to the Osage chief's trip. In Wood River, Clark was having a hard time holding the young lions in. During the day, they were packing, unpacking, repacking, as Clark experimented with various possibilities. At night, too many of them got drunk and brought on Clark's displeasure, but not much more because he recognized the cause of the problem and felt it would solve itself once they were underway. On May 7th, Clark loaded the keelboat. The following day, he and 20 oarsmen took it for a ride in the Mississippi to check its balance. Back on shore, Clark shifted more gear to the stern. On May 11th, Driard brought to camp seven voyagers who had been recruited in the St. Louis area with help from the Chouteaus. On Sunday, May 13th, Clark sent a message to Lewis in St. Louis. All was ready. The boat and pirogues were loaded. The boat would have 22 privates to row her, along with the three sergeants. One canoe would be paddled by six soldiers with Corporal Worthington. The other canoe would be paddled by eight French voyagers who would be returning with Worthington's group. The craft were complete with sails, etc., etc., men complete with powder cartridges and 100 balls each, all in health and readiness to set out. They had everything needed, they hoped. Clark entered an ominous note, saying they had enough of the necessary stores, as we thought ourselves authorized to procure. Not what the captains thought was needed, only what was authorized. In fact, Clark bluntly declared in his journal that the expedition did not have as many stores as I think necessary for the multitude of Indians through which we must pass on our road across the continent, etc. Nevertheless, the next morning, May 14th, Clark wrote in his journal, "Fixing for a start." That afternoon, he set off at 4 o'clock, under a gentle breeze, and made 4 miles up the Missouri. He camped on an island. He described the men as being in high spirits and said they were robust young backwoodsmen of character, healthy, hardy young men, recommended. The next day, he set out for St. Charles on the north bank of the Missouri, where he would shift the load again, having found that in the Missouri the concealed timber, either embedded in the river bottom or floating downstream almost completely submerged, was difficult to avoid and must be bumped into by the bow, rather than letting the bow ride up on the obstacles. That meant getting more goods in the bow, fewer in the stern. On May 16th, the expedition pulled into St. Charles, there to reload and wait for Captain Lewis to come up. Lewis was busy with the Osage party and with making arrangements for Captain Stoddard to act as his agent in St. Louis until he returned. On May 16th, he signed an authorization that gave Stoddard power to act in his behalf to draw bills of exchange on the Secretary of War to any amount which the nature of the service may, in your judgment and at your discretion, be deemed necessary. More specifically, Lewis declared that Indians would soon be arriving in St. Louis from upriver. He intended to select the delegations and start them on their way to Washington, where they would meet their new father. Lewis told Stoddard to spare no reasonable expense in getting these trans-Mississippi Indians to Washington and see to their comfort and protection, especially if they were Sioux, the most numerous and warlike tribe on the Missouri, and one Lewis especially wanted to impress. Further, Stoddard should pay the French voyagers when they returned to St. Louis. And if anyone showed up in St. Louis with a chit from Lewis, Stoddard should pay in cash and notify the Secretary of War. Any letters arriving for Lewis, from whatever quarter they may come, should be sent to Jefferson, who would hold them. Over the following couple of days, Lewis made last-minute preparations for Chouteau's and the Osage chief's trip to Washington. He prepared a package for Chouteau to carry to Jefferson, including mineral specimens, a horned lizard, a chart of the Mississippi from St. Louis to New Orleans, and a map of Upper Louisiana done by Clark and Lewis, based on the Evans map and on what they had heard from French boatmen around St. Louis. This map has been identified by Donald Jackson as the first cartographic product of the expedition. On May 19th, Chouteau's party set off for Washington. At noon on May 20th, Lewis set off by horseback for St. Charles, accompanied by Stoddard, two of his lieutenants, Auguste Chouteau, Charles Gratiot, and a dozen or more of the substantial inhabitants of St. Louis. Lewis made a journal entry about the trip, almost the only one he wrote between November 1803 and April 1805. He noted, "The first 5 miles of our route laid through a beautiful high level and fertile prairie which encircles the town of St. Louis." At 1:30 p.m., a violent thunderstorm forced the party to take shelter in a little cabin. The men remained an hour and a half and regaled ourselves with a cold collation which we had taken the precaution to bring with us from St. Louis. After the picnic, the rain continued. Impatient, Lewis said to hell with it and started off for St. Charles. Most of his companions accompanied him. They arrived at 6:30 and joined Captain Clark, found the party in good health and spirits. After a supper with the local officials, Lewis retired early to spend the night on the boat. In the morning, Clark said some of the men, 20 in all, wished to attend a final mass, and he had some rearrangements to make in the packing, so it would be mid-afternoon before the party could set off. Lewis took a look around St. Charles. Founded in 1769, it was a village of some 100 families living in homes Lewis described as small and but illy constructed. It had a chapel and a priest and about 450 inhabitants, overwhelmingly French Canadians. "Not an inconsiderable proportion of them," Lewis noted, "can boast a small dash of the pure blood of the Aborigines of America." Lewis hired two half-breeds, Pierre Peter Crouzat and Francis Labiche. Crouzat, son of a French father and an Omaha mother, was skilled in the sign language and spoke Omaha. Labiche spoke several native tongues. Lewis attached them to the permanent party after swearing them in as privates in the U.S. Army, a sure sign of his high approval of the two men. Clark had characterized the people of St. Charles as poor, polite, and harmonious. Lewis had a harsher judgment. He found them miserably poor, illiterate, and when at home, excessively lazy. Still, he found qualities to admire. They are polite, hospitable, and by no means deficient in point of natural genius. They live in a perfect state of harmony among each other. He regretted the influence of the Roman Catholic priest among them, a typical Virginia planter's prejudice, and regretted, too, that the men regarded the cultivation of the soil as a degrading occupation. To support their families, the men either undertook hunting trips to collect furs or hired themselves out as voyagers to paddle traders up the Missouri, the Osage, and other rivers. They were gone from 6 to 18 months at a time. Perhaps looking ahead to what faced him, Lewis said that the voyagers were always subjected to severe and incessant labor, exposed to the ferocity of the lawless savages, the vicissitudes of weather and climate, and dependent on chance or accident alone for food, raiment, or relief in the event of malady. Lewis had brought to Clark a letter from Clark's brother-in-law, William Croghan, which carried the welcome news that George Rogers Clark had revived from an illness that his family had feared would prove fatal. Just before setting out, Clark replied, giving the letter to Stoddard to take to St. Louis and post. He thanked Croghan for the news, which relieved him much, expressed the hope that he would be back in Clarksville in 2 years, and said, I think it more than probable that Captain Lewis or myself will return by sea, the other by the same route we proceed." He concluded with a description of the rain, thunder, and lightning of the previous 3 days, and admitted that it "discommodes me a little in sitting out." Discommoded or not, at 3:30 p.m., to the cheers of a crowd on the bank, the expedition set out. Captain Stoddard was there. A couple of weeks later, he reported to Dearborn that, as Lewis and his party had begun the ascent of the Missouri, in the boat and two pirogues, "all of them were deeply laden and well manned. His men possess great resolution, and they are in the best health and spirits." As the keelboat turned her bow into the stream, Lewis and his party cut themselves off from civilization. There would be no more incoming letters, no orders, no commissions, no fresh supplies, no reinforcements, nothing reaching them until they returned. The captains expected to be gone 2 years, perhaps more. In all that time, in whatever lay ahead of them, whatever decisions had to be made, they would receive no guidance from their superiors. This was an independent command, such as the U.S. Army had not previously seen and never would again. Lewis and Clark were as free as Columbus, Magellan, or Cook to make their mark on the sole basis of their own judgments and abilities. Their first afternoon together on the Missouri, they made 3.25 miles. They camped that night on the head of an island on the starboard side. Spring storms continued and a hard rain lasted through the night. At 6 o'clock a.m., May 22nd, they were on their way. Chapter 12. Up the Missouri, May to July 1804. The current ran at 5 miles per hour usually, but it sped up when it encountered encroaching bluffs, islands, sandbars, and narrow channels. The level was springtime high, almost flood stage. Incredible to behold were the obstacles, whole trees, huge trees, oaks and maples and cottonwoods that had been uprooted when a bank caved in, hundreds of large and thousands of smaller branches, sawyers, trees whose roots were stuck on the bottom and whose limbs sawed back and forth in the current, often out of sight, great piles of driftwood clumped together, racing downriver, threatening to tear holes in the sides of the boat, innumerable sandbars, always shifting, swirls and whirlpools beyond counting. This was worse than the Mississippi. How in the world did they move that bulky boat, overladen in the bow, against the full force and power of the Missouri? Donald Jackson gives us a vivid description. "A keelboat was a useful but ungainly craft. Loaded with 10 or 20 tons of cargo, and it was a faithful, wallowing drudge. Arm it with a swivel gun, set a guard with firearms at the gunwales, and it became a little warship. Navigating it downstream was easy if you kept an eye out for submerged logs, but going upstream there was no ideal way to keep it moving. If the wind was fair, you ran up a sail. When the wind failed, you broke out the iron-pointed setting poles and started pushing. If the bottom was deep enough, you could row. If the current was too swift for rowing, you could bend a 40-fathom length of cordling cable to the mast and put the crew ashore to haul on the line. Failing all this, you could tie up to the bank and wait for the wind to rise and blow fair." Despite everything, they made good time generally, and if the wind was astern, they made excellent time, once or twice 20 miles in a day. But when the wind wasn't astern, it required absolute vigilance and complete concentration by the captains and the sergeants, and total physical commitment from the men to make every mile. The labor of the men was incredible, whether pulling at the oars or pushing against their setting poles as they walked on top of the lockers from bow to stern. For Worthington's party in the white pirogue, and for the voyagers in the red pirogue, it was somewhat easier. Their craft were lighter and rode higher in the water. They were more maneuverable, so it was easier to turn away from danger. On the keelboat, to help dodge obstacles, the crew had to rush to one side or the other again and again. In the pirogues, all they had to do was lean. The privates on the keelboat were tough, alert, quick. On June 16th, Clark reported a typical incident. "Sand collecting, etc., forming bars and bars, washing away. The boat struck and turned. She was near oversetting. We saved her by some extraordinary exertions of our party, who are ever ready to encounter any fatigue for the promotion of the Enterprise. On June 1st, the party reached the Osage River and made camp on the point on the left side. The captains ordered all the trees in the area cut down so that they could make observations and stayed there through the next 2 days. They spent hours observing the time and distance from the sun to the nearest limb of the early morning sliver of a moon. Between 6:22 and 8:28 a.m., they recorded two sets of three figures each, a total of 36 times, or about one every 3 minutes. When the expedition was underway, Clark was more often on the keelboat, Lewis on shore, because Clark was the better waterman, Lewis the better scientist. More skilled in zoology than in botany, according to Jefferson, but good at both. Lewis took long, solitary walks, collecting specimens, animal and plant, noting the physical characteristics of the land, judging the fertility of the soil, the presence of springs of good water, likely sites for homesteads, trading posts, and fortifications. Alas, none of his notes for the spring and summer of 1804 are known to exist. It makes a terrible gap in the records. His notes would have expressed his first reactions to the biomass west of the Mississippi. This was hardly unknown territory. By 1804, the lower reaches of the Missouri had been much traveled. The creeks, islands, and prominent landforms all had names, mainly French. An accurate map existed through the mouth of the Kansas up to the entry of the Platte, and a pretty good map of the country from the Platte to the Mandan villages. But for Lewis, it was all new, and he was seeing it with different eyes. Up to the mouth of the Kansas, most of the flora and fauna were known to science. But there was more than enough of the new to keep Lewis happily busy, collecting and describing and preserving. After the hours at his instruments, squinting at the sky, calling out numbers for Clark to record, the hours he got to spend tramping around the prairie on the high ground up from the valley, doing what botanists like to do best, discovering new species, were surely welcome. But we can't catch his joy and wonder through his own words because we don't have his notes. Or any journal entry, even though in detachment orders that Lewis wrote and he and Clark signed and proclaimed on May 26th, Lewis ordered the sergeants, in addition to all other duties, to keep a separate journal from day to day of all passing occurrences and such other observations on the country, etc., as shall appear to them worthy of notice. It seems impossible that he could have issued such orders and not kept a daily journal himself, but if he did, we don't have it. Thus, as the keelboat makes its way west across the present state of Missouri, then turns north at the mouth of the Kansas toward the Platte and on into the Dakotas, we see Lewis only through the eyes of other men, principally William Clark. Clark was a great writer about events in which he participated and described the country he was passing through with a lovely lyric quality, but he could be disappointingly terse when writing about an event he had not seen with his own eyes. Thus, on the second day of the journey, May 23rd, he wrote, "Captain Lewis ascended the hill which has peninsulas projecting in ragged points to the river and was near falling from a peninsula of rocks 300 feet. He caught at 20 foot. Saved himself by the assistance of his knife." Surely Lewis told Clark more than Clark recorded about such a life-threatening incident. As soldiers who either learned lessons or died, they had a need to talk over incidents that threatened the expedition. They had to avoid unnecessary risks. So Lewis must have told Clark in some detail how he came to fall and how he saved himself, but this didn't make it into Clark's journal entry. There is another tantalizing item. The next day, the expedition passed Boone Settlement. The village consisted of a colony of Kentuckians led by Daniel Boone, who had settled there in 1799 on a grant of land from the Spanish government. The man who had blazed the way into Kentucky was creating a farmstead for his family on the river. Lewis and Clark went ashore. The settlers flocked around them. The men bought corn and butter. Then they were off. Did Lewis and Clark meet Daniel Boone? Did they shake his hand? Did he wish them luck, offer advice, or a drink? Did he pass the torch? Lewis and Clark meeting Daniel Boone sounds like a Charlie Russell painting, or a marvelous scene for a novel. But had he met Boone, surely Clark would have written about it. And there is no known Lewis entry for the day. The next day, May 25th, the expedition passed La Charrette, the last settlement of whites on the river. French and American settlers had lived there for 4 or 5 years. Daniel Boone would move there in 1805. The site is gone now, washed away by the river. Clark recorded, "The people at this village is poor, houses small. They sent us milk and eggs to eat." The main Lewis document available for this period is his May 26th detachment orders. It established the routine and serves as a reminder that this was much more than a bunch of the guys out on an exploring and collecting expedition. This was a military expedition into hostile territory. From Jefferson's point of view, the captains were on an expedition to explore newly acquired territory, to find the water route to the Pacific, to extend commerce, to collect specimens for science, and to establish an American claim on the Oregon country. From the point of view of the various Indian tribes, the keel boat carried uninvited strangers into their midst and their land. The United States had bought Louisiana from Napoleon, but not the loyalty or alliance or subservience of the people who lived in Louisiana. For Lewis and Clark, every strange Indian tribe encountered had to be considered belligerent until it proved otherwise. The Indians, they hoped, would be willing to talk and trade, but it would be the Indians' choice. They might decide to fight. Certainly they would be tempted. The expedition's arsenal was by far the biggest ever brought to the Missouri country, and any tribe able to take possession of it would dominate the region, no matter what the Louisiana Purchase said, for a long time to come. The last thing Lewis wanted was an Indian fight. He was prepared, and was under orders, to do everything possible to avoid one. The best way to avoid a fight was to make sure one never got started, which meant in the first instance making certain that the expedition was never caught by surprise. A camp of